If you want to go ahead and click on Start Blog.
Welcome to GoToWebinar, Web Events Made Easy. Welcome to the webinar. You have entered as an organizer and may now speak to any other organizers or panelists on the line. When you are ready to begin the presentation, press the Start Broadcast button on the GoToWebinar control panel to allow all attendees to hear you. This system will notify you once you begin your broadcast.
You're a research scientist in the Improvement Science Research Network's Coordinating Center. The ISRN is the only improvement research network sponsored by the National Institutes of Health and has a long-standing commitment to evidence-based practice. The ISRN is a one-of-its-kind national practice-based research network whose mission is focused on accelerating interprofessional improvement science in a systems context across multiple hospital sites. In this mission, the ISRN aims to enhance the scientific foundation for quality improvement, safety, and efficiency through transdisciplinary research addressing healthcare delivery, patient-centeredness, and the integration of evidence into practice. We are excited about today's topic and glad to see you share our enthusiasm by your attendance. We will poll the audience in a few minutes to get a better sense of who has joined us today. We also welcome your thoughts on other topics we could address of future interest to you. At the end of today's session, we will be asking you to complete a brief evaluation form. Please be sure to give us your feedback since your comments will help us plan for future events. Next slide, please. While we don't anticipate any technical problems, I'd like to give you a few tips in case you experience any difficulty. For help, please notify the ISRN staff through the questions window. And by contacting the ISRN staff, please select organizers to reach us directly. If you have any troubles with the slides or have problems with your connection to the web event, either try refreshing your screen or logging off and logging back into the web seminar. This should help. Also, this web seminar is being recorded. A download of this recording, the slides, and a transcript will be available on the ISRN website soon. As registrants, you will all be notified via email when the archive is available. Next slide, please. Note that you can submit questions at any time through the questions window at the bottom of the presentation screen, as pictured in the screenshot. One thing with the topic that we're discussing today, we want you to keep in mind, or what we want to address, what your number one IRB-related question is. And so as we go through our presentation today, we want you to think about what burning IRB questions that you may have, and we'll do our best to address them at the end of this presentation. Next slide, please. To listen to this web seminar, it's preferred that you use speakers connected to your computer. Make sure that the mic and speakers button is selected in your audio options window. If you do not have speakers on your computer, you may use your phone to listen to today's presentation. To do this, dial the number on your screen and enter the unique access code and audio PIN in the audio options window. Make sure the telephone option is selected in the audio window. Next slide, please. Before I turn the program over to our presenter, I'd like to get a sense of who we have in the audience today. Please answer the polling question that you're going to see on your screen in a few seconds here, and let us know who you are by describing your role among the categories listed. The categories we have listed here are frontline clinical, management, academic faculty clinical educator, researcher or scientist, or other healthcare professional. Please take a second and select what segment of the population you represent. Based on the results of our survey, quick survey here, it looks like our top three categories of participants are academic faculty, clinical educator, researcher or scientist, and other healthcare professionals. The information presented in this web event will be useful to a broad array of participants, but it's helpful to know who's joined us. We welcome all of you and thank you for your participation in today's web seminar. The ISRN's current network study has engaged 15 hospitals across the country in self-detection of operational failures. The Small Troubles Adaptive Responses study is a multi-site study generated through the ISRN. And through the 15 different hospitals, the ISRN and the study sites are continuously engaged with institutional review boards across the country. Next slide, please. As defined by the Code of Federal Regulations, research means a systematic investigation, including research development, testing, and evaluation designed to develop or contribute to generalizable knowledge. Activities which meet this definition constitute research for the purposes of this policy, whether or not they are conducted or supported under a program which is considered research for other purposes. For example, some demonstration and service programs may include research activities. This web event promises an interesting discussion on the regulatory issues associated with hospital-based quality improvement. Today's presentation will provide first-hand experiences and real-life examples of the different interpretations of this definition. We hope that this afternoon's web seminar will provide the evidence that you need as you progress to conducting multi-site research with the Improvement Science Research Network. With that, I'm delighted to introduce our speaker for today's web seminar, Dr. Christine Goschel. Dr. Goschel is the Director of Strategic Development and Research Initiatives for the Johns Hopkins Armstrong Institute for Patient Safety and Quality, and also acts as a co-director for an AHRQ Action 2 Research Partnership. She's an assistant professor in the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Nursing, and Public Health. Dr. Goschel teaches courses on quality and patient safety, as a frequent speaker both nationally and internationally, with a particular interest in cultivating clinical and administrative leadership in improving the science of healthcare delivery. Dr. Goschel has significant healthcare leadership experience first as a critical care nurse, then as a hospital executive, and more recently as a developer and first leader of the Keystone Center at the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, where she collaborated with Dr. Peter Tonovos on groundbreaking efforts to reduce bloodstream infections in intensive care units in Michigan. She joined Dr. Tonovos' research team at Johns Hopkins in 2006 and has contributed to large-scale ICU improvement projects in Spain, England, and Peru, and to an AHRQ-funded initiative that is spreading the Hopkins bloodstream infection program to every state in the United States, as well as Puerto Rico. Dr. Goschel, thank you so much for joining us today and presenting on such an interesting and important topic. I'd like to turn this presentation over to you now.
Great. Thank you so much, and good afternoon, everyone. I am delighted that you chose to join today to discuss a topic for which I have some pretty significant personal experience, not necessarily of the positive kind. Part of what we are going to do this afternoon, I hope, is to share a little bit about my experiences, but then also get some feedback from those of you that are on the line relative to the challenges that you face. Could we have the next slide, please? Specifically, it's important for me to note that I have no conflicts of interest to disclose, that the information I'm going to provide you today is drawn from public domain documents and my personal experiences. The information that I'm going to talk about does not represent official or unofficial policies of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine or any of its institutional review boards. Next slide, please. So I'm hoping that we can chat just a little bit this afternoon about the role of the Office of Human Research Protections, or OHARP, that I can describe to you vis-a-vis my experiences some of the regulatory challenges of quality improvement research, and I think we will have time at the end of the presentation for each of you to share the challenges that you face, because that's truly where the richness in this network, if you will, strengthens the knowledge of all of us. I'm going to talk a bit about a specific defining case of which I have great personal knowledge, and then we'll talk a little about some of the requirements that you might think through in determining whether the HHS regulations for protection of human subjects and research apply to your work, and then finally we'll close with a little discussion about what's on the horizon. Next slide, please. So many of you are academic researchers, so you are well versed in the fact that the Office of Human Research Protections is an arm of the agency of the Department of Health and Human Services. Contrary to, I'm going to say, belief in some of our clinical offices and where we scratch our heads, the role of OHARP really is to protect human subjects. It's not to make life difficult for researchers. Yet many of us struggle with how to consider whether our work is truly research quality improvement or whether we need to submit it to the internal review board. I would point all of us on the call today to the OHARP website. It is increasingly rich. If you've not picked up the phone and called OHARP to ask them a question, my personal experience is that you will be greeted by very friendly, helpful bureaucrats but there's a tremendous amount of accessible information on the website, and the link is there. Could we have the next slide, please? It's really important, and in my personal experience, useful, to think through the purpose of OHARP as the starting point for your discernment around a study or a quality improvement activity that you may be embarking upon. So the Office for Human Research Protections has as its charge to provide leadership in the protection of the rights, welfare, and well-being of subjects involved in research that is conducted or supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. But let's look at this again. Leadership in the protection of the rights, welfare, and well-being of subjects involved in research that is conducted or supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It doesn't say anything about privately funded research, doesn't say anything about international research. That doesn't mean that similar standards don't apply, but I think it's crucially important to understand not only the confines for the OHARP authority, but also that for studies that some of us do that transcend these bounds of authority, that we may need to look places beyond OHARP for guidance. OHARP helps ensure those protections by providing both clarification and guidance, by helping develop and provide educational programs and materials. They certainly maintain regulatory oversight, and they're more than willing to provide advice on ethical and regulatory issues in biomedical and sociobehavioral research. Let's go to the next slide, please. Some of the challenges that currently confront OHARP and those of us in academia as well as in community hospitals and outpatient settings that are increasingly involved in quality improvement activities is really determining whether what we're doing is subject to IRB review. Some of the language around the work that we are doing has made our efforts more and more suspect in terms of submitting to a review board. The language around, you know, we used to talk about quality improvement studies, and everyone is now talking about implementation science. Implementation science is absolutely a step forward, and it is indeed what we do, but the very notion of science brings with it the expectation of new knowledge, that we're discovering new knowledge. The second consideration is that in many of our quality activities, we truly do want what we learn to be just generalizable. So we expect to share what we're learning. And as we look at the federal regulations, some of the earlier descriptions of what stipulates what should be taken forward to the IRB is whether you're looking at scientific discovery and generalizable knowledge. The notion of informed consent we'll talk about in a minute when I get into the concrete example that I'm going to talk about, but the notion of informed consent, and I know many of my colleagues and some of the students that I am privileged to work with here at Hopkins, you know, scratch their heads and say, well, you know, if I have to get informed consent, then I'm not going to do this. But if I don't do it and if I don't need informed consent, then it clearly can't be research. There's a lot of sorting through to do with this. There are questions around whether the analysis of administrative data, is research or not, and then obviously the whole quagmire around HIPAA considerations as we do our work. Next slide, please. So a little bit of the introduction told you a bit about who I am. But how I got to where I am is perhaps a bit more appropriate and informative in terms of where we're going to go next. I'm a relatively new researcher. I spent most of my life as a nurse, first at the bedside and then in a number of administrative roles in a hospital and health system, then senior leadership positions, ultimately going, as was mentioned, to the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, where I created the Keystone Center for Patient Safety and Quality, and partnered with Peter Pronovost at Hopkins. I'm a voracious reader, was then, still am, was very familiar with work that he was doing at Hopkins that had been published about how to reduce bloodstream infections. There was an opportunity through the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality to secure funding to improve patient safety. Back in the day, 2003, patient safety matching grants. I remember the RFA well. I approached Peter Pronovost about working with us at the Hospital Association, at the Keystone Center, to bring together hospitals in Michigan to do this work, to try to replicate what he had done at Johns Hopkins. And on the one hand, we could say the rest is history. A lot has been written about the success of the Keystone ICU initiative. But when I approached him, I came at that as a master's prepared clinician who had spent most of my life in administration. So the nuances of was it research or was it not research is certainly not my forte. And yet Dr. Pronovost and his team were well versed in all the nuances of research. They had and continued to conduct lots of research. And so I was pretty comfortable that what we were doing was appropriate and safe and had followed all of the IRB rules and regulations as tightly defined by OHRQ. Now that Michigan study had in it over 100 intensive care units from 77 hospitals. And at the very beginning of the work we discussed, and I was well versed with internal review boards and institutional research oversight from my role as an administrator. But Dr. Pronovost and his team, indeed, as the principal investigator, this study had been submitted at Hopkins, was deemed exempt research. That's how the proposal was submitted, and we were good to go. Some of the hospitals in Michigan said, you know, at our hospital, we really want to make sure that our IRB is okay with this. And so a number of hospitals submitted the study to their own IRBs and received similar exempt status. Let's go to the next slide. The results of that project that I just talked about received tremendous attention, not only because the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality estimated that they saved about $200 for every dollar that they invested. We did financial calculations on the gains. We looked at numbers needed to treat and estimated the savings in lives, about 1,500 lives and $200 million annually in Michigan. Those are pretty significant savings. Caught the attention of a lot of groups, not surprisingly. So I'm going to talk with you for the next few minutes about what we actually did, because when we finish, we're going to apply this and think through whether we believe this was research or not, because I hope that this case study will provide some useful and practical ways for you to think through your own projects. So what did we do in the Michigan project exactly? Next slide, please. We familiarized those 100-plus intensive care units with what Hopkins had developed as a process to translate research evidence into practice, or TRIP. What the team of researchers at Hopkins had done was summarize the empirical evidence, what had been published about what worked, published by the APIC and SHE and CDC. This was not remote evidence. This was not controversial, well-known clinical evidence for how to reduce infections. Next, they considered the evidence and identified local barriers to implementation. So they tested this. This is what they had done at Johns Hopkins in the surgical ICU that Peter had published, which demonstrated that the SICU had gotten their bloodstream infection rates down to near zero. They came up with a way to really measure performance. So when they identified local barriers to implementation, they created, if you will, and were able to zero in on some interventions that had the lowest barriers to implementation, the now famous and totally mythical checklist. There was a checklist for insertion, which we'll talk about in a moment, but hospitals created their own checklist for how to do this work. But within each, there were the five components of clinical evidence well published in the literature: wash your hands, use chlorhexidine, full barrier precautions, remove lines when you can, avoid the femoral site. not rocket science, not controversial. We measured performance and made sure that patients received the intervention. So we implemented a daily goals process where key questions were asked every day for every patient regarding whether the line needed to come out or not. The second part of that study involved training the teams that were doing the work using the Comprehensive Unit Safety Program, or CUSP. CUSP is an intervention that's designed to help frontline caregivers and senior executives partner in the improvement of care by addressing cultural factors. So the steps of CUSP, this is really difficult work to do. It's adaptive work. It requires changing attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors. But the steps to CUSP are pretty simplistic. We have tools and train folks on the science of safety, so understanding principles of safety and safe design. Once caregivers and executives have received basic training in the science of safety, we ask them to use the lenses they have now developed to identify defects or harms, potential harms, in the care delivery process. They work with the executive that's assigned to their unit to begin to mitigate those harms. They learn from mistakes when they happen, so not just recovering from mistakes, but really learning from them, and we provide tools for that. And then the fifth step of the CUSP process involves giving teams tools to improve teamwork and communication and asking them to test those. Next slide, please. The clinical evidence that we relied on for the checklist that was used in this intervention came particularly from the Guidelines for the Prevention of Intravascular Catheter-Related Infections and a study by Dr. Len Mermel on the prevention of catheter-related infections that was in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Next slide. What were the interventions? I've already told you. Remove unnecessary lines, wash your hands prior to the procedure, use maximal barrier precautions, clean the skin with chlorhexidine, and avoid the femoral site and ask every day that removal question, can the line come out? Now, what's stunning about this is that when we first began to introduce the project, both senior leaders and frontline caregivers said, we already do this. This isn't new. We do this. Clearly, as clinicians, as caregivers, we often understand what the evidence is, and we may believe that we're applying it every single time, but when we take a closer look, there's often opportunities to improve. And indeed, that was the case with the Michigan Project. Let's look at the next slide, please. We developed some mechanisms to help get folks truly immersed in the work. So understanding that it takes different bits of data and information to engage senior leaders than it does frontline staff, we developed mechanisms to get folks engaged, and we asked that they consider whether what they are doing makes the world a better place. And we gave them tools. These are adaptive interventions focused on, again, attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors. We centralized the education, the technical components. So we pulled together the literature. We gave folks the checklist for intervention based on the evidence. We talked about the evidence. We helped them think through and share the examples that had been part of the Hopkins work in terms of pulling together all of the materials that you need in one place, simplifying processes, redundancies, etc. We encouraged them to adapt what we gave them and implement in their local setting, understanding that we needed to respect local wisdom. So educating, helping folks answer the question, what did they need to do and how could they do it with their resources, and finally we evaluated. And we now that I'm at Hopkins, but at the time I was in Michigan, Hopkins did the evaluation using statisticians and technically trained staff to really aggregate the data and help us understand with scientifically sound methods and knowledge whether or not teams were actually improving patient safety. Next slide, please. This happens to be a slide many of you may have seen of the initial work that I read that Peter had published that showed that with some very simple interventions, creating a policy, establishing a line card, implementing daily goals that included a checklist, and empowering nursing to speak up if they saw a breach in sterile technique, that in fact there had been a dramatic reduction in bloodstream infections in the ICU at Hopkins. Next slide. With the surgical ICU. The Michigan Keystone ICU project, again, over 100 intensive care units, similar dramatic reduction sustained over time. The 36 months out, precipitous drop. It's interesting that when we submitted the proposal to the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, our initial aim was to reduce infections by 50%, and you can see where we started, near 3, 2.7 in fact. But what we saw is that very quickly teams began to get to zero, much as had happened at Hopkins, and we questioned whether we could in fact leave the targeted goal for the study at 50%. So in future iterations, we really have folks aiming for zero. But again, you can see the results for yourself, dramatic improvements. Next slide. After the Michigan work, the Hopkins team worked with Rhode Island, and again, similar improvements. Next slide. What's perhaps less known but was published earlier this year, similar sorts of dramatic reductions in ventilator-associated pneumonias using that same TRIP process, so looking at empirical evidence that's out in the field that's not controversial, that's widely accepted, partnering with a comprehensive unit safety program, dramatic reductions in ventilator-associated pneumonias. Next slide, please. Safety climate, that comprehensive unit safety program really geared at improving attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors as we talked about. And what this slide demonstrates that you're looking at is that we measured safety climate using the safety attitudes questionnaire, and there was significant improvement between 2004 during the baseline assessment and 2006. And this represents the perceptions of the caregivers in the intensive care units. These represent all 108 intensive care units that completed the safety attitudes questionnaires during both time periods. Again, dramatic improvement in how caregivers perceive the quality of safety in their unit. Next slide. That work got adopted eventually by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality and is now being implemented across the country. There are 9 more months left in the national study. At the time that this slide was created, we had 47 states on board and almost 1,100 hospitals engaged in the work. Next slide. Now, what happened as a part of that? As a result of those efforts, dramatic improvements in Michigan hospitals, dramatic improvements beginning to happen across the country. This notice from the Centers for Disease Control from May of last year pointing out that in fact, dramatic reductions in central line-associated bloodstream infections in ICU across the country, yet infections from central lines in other patient populations are on the increase. Next slide. And we're going to get to the relevance of this for OHARP in just about 30 seconds. Now, something else started to happen in the Michigan work, and that is people were curious about what was really going on because the evidence was pretty clear. It was, you know, aggregated data, but 108 units, lots of data, not much missing data, good rigorous analysis, dramatic reduction in bloodstream infections. A doctoral student in the School of Public Health, Dr. Allison Lippitz, Schneiderman now, did a separate study looking at the hospital mortality in Michigan hospitals pre-implementation. The blue line is Michigan hospitals that were in the study. Pre-implementation of this intervention, during intervention and post-intervention, and what you can see is that there was about a 10% greater reduction in hospital mortality for Medicare patients in Michigan than in 11 surrounding states. We believe that that's because of the work that we did to help improve the safety culture. Next slide. A recent study published this year, again, side study, looking at the business case. 30 CLABSIs were averted annually in most of these facilities. This was the average, 18 VAPs. Financial benefits exceeded the cost of intervention, $1.1 million a year for the average hospital. Next slide. We published another important paper earlier this year that really took a deeper dive into what was happening in the clinical setting to allow these changes to occur. we worked with Dr. Mary Dixon Woods from the University of Leicester in England and Dr. Charles Bosk from the University of Pennsylvania. They're medical sociologists and ethnographers, and we did a deep dive into what was really happening in the Michigan study. But before I go to the next slide, now that you've heard what we did in Michigan, the empiric evidence, best practice, wash your hands, perhaps what you're not familiar with, and the reason that I was invited to talk a bit with you this afternoon, is that when the results of this study were first published in December of 2006 in the New England Journal of Medicine, it was one of the first times that a quality improvement research study hit the lead article in a medical journal as significant as the New England Journal. It wasn't too much after that that the Office of Human Research Protections contacted Johns Hopkins and basically shut the program down. There had been a concern sent to OHARP by an unnamed consumer, concerned that we didn't have the appropriate IRB approvals for the study and that patients had not been appropriately consented to participate in this research. You've just heard what we did, how we did it, published the results, and in a somewhat alarming, from my perspective, and I think from the research team at Hopkins, in a somewhat alarming turn of events, the Office of Human Research Protections contacted and said, in obviously fully consistent with their challenge and their charge of protecting human subjects and the well-being of people involved in research, they needed to ask us to explain completely what we had done, and the program went on hold. Next slide, please. The challenge for each of us and for OHARP at that point in time was to ask the key questions that we all need to consider when we're examining our studies and trying to determine, again, where we go with what we do. The first question is, does the activity involve research? And if you look at the Code of the Federal Register, the 46.102D, you'll find the complete definitions there. If the answer to the first question is yes, this is research, then the second question is, does the research activity involve human subjects? And again, the reference is there so that you can go back and take a look if you're not familiar with it, in terms of the definitions of human subjects research. If, in fact, you've determined that what you're doing is research and it does involve human subjects, the next question is, does the research qualify for an exemption? And you may remember that I said at the outset, the Michigan study, that's our case study for today, was submitted as exempt, and that was the status that we did the work under, so an exempt status. The fourth question is, if it's not exempt human subjects research, or non-exempt human subjects research, is the research being conducted or supported by the Health and Human Services or otherwise covered by applicable federal-wide assurances that are approved by OHARP? So there are circumstances where there are other large groups that actually cover research and that are approved by OHARP. And so the question is the research that you're conducting supported, paid for, and supported by HHS or another FWA? Next slide, please. If you've determined that you're doing research, if the research involves human subjects, is not exempt, and is conducted or supported by HHS or otherwise covered by an applicable FWA, you have to have IRB review. It's easy to build yourself a checklist for these steps. Many of you probably have. The next slide, please. What about the myths? So the end of the Michigan story is that after about 9 months, an extremely thorough review of all of the processes, the interventions, the fact that there was absolutely no identifiable data collected at any point in that project, that all of the interventions were well within the scope of common practice and empirical evidence that was published and not controversial, the determination was made that, in fact, the Michigan study was research, which is what Dr. Pronovost and the team believed at the outset. But that rather than being exempt, the study should have been considered for expedited review with waiver of consent. So it should have gone to the IRB. This was the determination of OHARP. Should have gone to the IRB for expedited review. Wouldn't have to go to the full committee for review, but could go for expedited review, and that it did qualify for waiver of consent, since, again, the treatments that were part of the protocol were absolutely not researched. They were well vetted in the literature, were common practice, that the research had to do with whether common interventions that had been effective at Hopkins could, in fact, be translated to a larger population to result in generalizable improvements in clinical outcomes and safety culture. The last determination by OHARP, as the ban was lifted on the Michigan study, and I think quality improvement organizations across the country issued a collective sigh of relief. There had been hearings at OHARP. There were stories about this in most of the popular quality improvement media. There was an article in the New York Times, all concerned that we would shut down quality improvement activities that are at the very heart of making healthcare safer if, in fact, studies like the one in Michigan were deemed to require informed consent and, I'm going to say, more rigorous oversight than what had been provided initially. And in fact, OHARP came back and said it was research, should have been considered as for expedited review with waiver of consent rather than exempt. But in fact, at this point in time, work using CUSP and efforts to improve or reduce bloodstream infections using the sorts of interventions that we did in Michigan are now quality improvement because they've been proven not only at an individual institution, but on a broad scale. So for the national project to reduce CLABSI, IRB absolutely not required. The full history of that Michigan study is available for you to read if you're interested on the OHARP website. There were also a number of external researchers and scientists who published opinions and ideas and articles as an outgrowth of that Michigan challenge, and perhaps one of my personal favorites and one that does a great job of walking through the challenges was written by a perspective that was written by Dr. Franklin Miller and Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel and was published in the New England Journal of Medicine as a perspective on February 21st in 2008. And it really does a rather thorough job of walking through both the Michigan study and the challenges that we faced. It lists for anyone who's interested, again, the considerations that need to be taken into thought when waiving informed consent, the key questions that we've already talked about, is it research, is it human subjects research, is it eligible for informed consent, and if it's not eligible for informed consent, the submission to the IRB. But there are many other myths that I've discovered since going down this path, and I want to help dispel a little of, or at least a few of them today, before we see whether you have some questions about this work. Next slide, please. The first myth is that if we're conducting research, we have to get informed consent. Now, that may be less of a concern by seasoned researchers, but I bump shoulders pretty regularly with students and new graduates who truly want to begin their careers, and this whole idea of patient-informed consent is challenging. Research can qualify for expedited review with waiver of consent when, and these properties are important, when the risk to the subjects is minimal. When you think about that Michigan study, the risks to the subjects, if having to do with removing lines if they're not necessary, washing, scrubbing the site with chlorhexidine, full barrier precautions, etc. Risks to subjects is really extremely minimal. A second qualification for waiver is whether subjects' rights and the welfare won't be affected by the waiver. So if there is no consent, there's not going to be any change in treatment or any undue risk. The third is that conducting the research without the waiver isn't practicable. Now think about that. For many of our quality improvement projects, therein lies much of our discussion. It would not be practical to get informed consent from every patient in every hospital for what in many instances is routine best practice care. But understanding whether that routine best practice care actually results in improved outcomes is important. And when we learn what works, being able to share that, we would love to have generalizable. And so this, the muddiness around research versus quality improvement hits home. But if it's not practicable, think about that. Finally, if appropriate, waiver of consent can happen, and in some circumstances, patients can be provided with additional pertinent information about participation after their study is done. So it may have been, and we have, clearly the tide is turning in terms of reducing CLAB fees, but there certainly were patients, some of the hospitals that participated in the Michigan study gave patients cards that said, ask us about the Keystone ICU project. These patients learned and knew in a very non-traditional, it certainly was not informed consent, but they were informed that in their particular institutions, teams were exerting extra effort to try and provide all the best practices to achieve some significant improvements that were just beginning to become obvious in other institutions. Next slide, please. Another myth is that if you intend to publish, you have to get IRB approval. Now, this is one that has its roots, is really a heuristic technique to assess intent. You know, the federal regulations broadly define research as a systematic investigation, including research development, testing and evaluation, designed to develop or contribute to generalizable knowledge. So think about this. If research is systematic investigation, QI can also be systematic investigation. Research development, QI has to have a good development and design. Testing and evaluation is increasingly part of our knowledge translation and implementation science, what we used to call quality improvement work. If our activities are designed to develop or contribute to generalizable knowledge, this was one of the things with the Michigan study that allowed us to fall under scrutiny, because we made it very clear at the outset that we wanted to see if what Hopkins had achieved could be achieved on a broader scale. So we absolutely wanted to contribute to generalizable knowledge. However, the intent to publish is not in and of itself a requirement for IRB approval. The flip side of that is that many of the journals in which we try to share our quality improvement activities really are looking for IRB approval. And so many folks submit to the IRB because they want an IRB determination because they do intend to publish and they think it will hurt their publication chances. This is one of the areas that those of us who are quality improvement professionals need to work on as we go forward, the opportunity to publish in improvement science without having to go through additional regulatory hoops when they're not legally necessary. Next slide, please. What changes are on the horizon? And in a few moments, we're going to talk about what this might mean for you and for all of us. Now, interestingly enough, on July 22nd of last year, Health and Human Services put forth a proposal to improve the rules protecting human subjects. Public comment was solicited, and I hope we can get a few questions on this. Public comment was solicited for first revising the risk-based framework to more accurately calibrate the level of review to the level of risk. Let's think through this again. Revising the risk-based framework to more accurately calibrate the level of review to the level of the risk. This begins to get after the flourishing of implementation science research, much of which fits the categories that we talked about in terms of expedited review with waiver of consent. People have tended to be much more cautious in their quality improvement and implementation research than perhaps they would have been before the Michigan study, but OHARP is recognizing that the world has changed. As scientists, we have the opportunity and are really focusing on trying to understand and create best evidence for how to implement safe care and advance the science of healthcare delivery. This calls for different regulations perhaps than existed in the past. The second change that was suggested, and they were soliciting comments, had to do with using a single IRB review for all domestic sites of multi-site trials. Many of you, there were conversations at the beginning of our presentation today about multi-site trials that are happening through the Implementation Science Research Network, and in fact the challenges of multiple IRB reviews, slows down and makes many projects not realistic. Next slide, please. OHARP has heard loud and clear that there's need to think through, again, updating the forms and processes that are used for informed consent. We live in a world where electronic access to information is becoming more universal than just a few years past, and some of the parameters around the forms that we must submit for IRB approval are archaic, and they're recognizing that. The next big concern of OHARP, and this is huge. Probably, if it could be in bold font and much larger type, that would have been appropriate. OHARP is really struggling and asks for lots of public comment on how to establish mandatory data security and information protection standards for studies that involve identifiable or potentially identifiable data, and I'll tell you a bit of a story about that in just a moment. The fifth area of potential change was how to develop and implement a systematic approach to the collection and analysis of data on unanticipated problems and adverse events around all clinical trials. Increasingly, in a world in which we can aggregate data pretty quickly, the idea that we are learning about problems one study at a time is no longer tenable. The opportunity and the responsibility, perhaps, to have a systematic and easy way to understand across trials the adverse events that are happening is becoming a true public concern and fits under the charge of OHARP relative to public welfare. Let's look at the next slide, please. The sixth area of potential change has to do with extending federal regulatory protections to apply to all research conducted at U.S. institutions receiving funding from Common Rule agencies. So expanding this not just to HHS, et cetera, but across agencies. And finally, to provide uniform guidance on federal regulations, it is not unusual to get conflicting messages about what we must do and how we must do it from competing federal agencies. Now, before I close, and I think we have time for a few questions, I want to go back for a moment to point four in terms of what was on the horizon, and that had to do with mandatory data security and information protection standards. One of the greatest risks to human subjects in research and in the world in which we live is the disclosure of data about their personal health and safety that can have ramifications both in terms of their ability to be insured, their ability to be employed, all of the implications that we might imagine that because of the proliferation of social media, because quite honestly, as researchers and clinicians and healthcare workers, we have become a bit sloppy. When I first entered healthcare, we used to talk about, remember, don't talk about patients in the elevator because caregivers would talk about a case and you know, someone could overhear. In a conversation that I had with a high-ranking official from OHARP about a year ago, and I said, you know, what's your number one challenge right now? You know, the Michigan thing is a little bit past history, and some organizations have established separate IRBs for quality improvement studies, and increasingly, you know, we know that you, OHARP, are looking at trying to educate us on assessing based on, you know, research, and is it human subjects research, and what is the risk, et cetera. And without blinking, this person said our number one challenge is social media. Clinicians are sharing information. Clinicians not thinking are sharing not only research information, but HIPAA violations, obviously. And I think most of you have probably seen some pretty tremendous fines lately about HIPAA violations. As a researcher, you need to think really clearly about not just HIPAA, but the data that we collect as part of our studies. Where is it stored? How secure is it? What is the education and training of our research team such that everyone is on board and well-versed in how to protect the data that we have in our trust? So I think more to come on this. The final regulations, the public comment was all in. The final regulations have not been shared yet, but I would encourage you to stay tuned to the OHARP website for more information and to not hesitate to pick up the call and pick up the phone and call or email your questions. Now, as we close, I see that we have a hot question here, which I'll answer momentarily. It says, someone was asking whether if the intervention was delayed for 9 months, comment on the number of patients harmed because the practice improvement was halted. That's a really important question. The research, quote, was halted for 9 months, which meant we couldn't collect the data. But because, in fact, the Michigan teams were implementing best practice research, they didn't change how they cared for patients. They continued to use the checklist. They continued to work to reduce infections. It's just that at the central research team, we couldn't have access to that data because we were using that data to analyze what was working and what was not and how we could generalize. I'm sorry, I talked too long, looks like here. The final slide is one that represents a poster that we have in our research team office here at Hopkins. And Peter Pronovost often quotes, and I think everyone here, our growing research team, understands and believes this. And in the words of Margaret Mead, the notion is that as we do implementation research, as we work to advance the science of safety, we have to acknowledge that this really takes courage. But we can't doubt that any small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world because, indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. I thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about the challenges of quality improvement versus research. I think the bottom line is always to go back to the official rules and regulations. Ask yourself the four key questions as ARC lays them out. Don't hesitate to use the resources that we all have available to us through OHARP, through our IRBs. Pick up the phone and call and ask. Everyone has the same goal in this, and that really is the protection of human subjects, the protection of welfare. No one wants to slow down the progression of innovation or of implementation of best practices. We are all learning together, and because of social media, because of the capacity to aggregate data in ways we never have before, the opportunity is absolutely in front of us. We need to not shy away from it, but we need to keep in mind that indeed patients' protection is at the heart of what we do, and we can't lose that. With that, I'm going to stop and see whether there are any questions or final comments from our hosts. Thank you so much.
Christine, thank you so much for such an insightful presentation. And we do have some questions that have come up from the audience, some that I've pushed to you already, but some that I'm going to ask you here specifically. Our first question actually comes from a student. She says she's a DNP student, a doctorate in nursing practice student, and she indicates that she needs to complete a quality improvement project as a part of her capstone project for her degree. And she asks, how does IRB affect her project? And the second part of that question is do IRB approvals, are they required for coursework associated projects?
That's a great question. IRB approval is required for studies that have the potential to impact on human subjects or the common good. So depending upon your program, absolutely IRB approval may be required. The same steps that apply if you're an independent researcher, apply if you're a student. So if the study that you're going to do really is research according to the definition, if it does involve the activity, the intervention that you're going to do involves human subjects, you need to think through the steps and understand whether it qualifies for an exemption or not. I am totally biased in this regard, but I love for DNP students and others to actually conduct research that requires IRB consideration, because one of the things that I think is important about the whole learning opportunity is to become familiar with submitting a study for IRB approval. As researchers, we all need to understand and to develop skills in going down this path. So for students, I think it's a particularly valuable opportunity, but depending upon the particular focus of his or her capstone, the answer could differ.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to put our ISRN hat on right now, and like we had indicated previously in this presentation, we do conduct multi-site research, and looking at the slide that you had, it was about things that were on the horizon, and one, yeah. I think the second bullet that you had in there was a statement that said possibly moving to a single IRB to review all domestic multi-site studies. Given the responsibility that IRBs have for their local institution, I want you to put your IRB professional, IRB director hat on now, and tell me what your thoughts are from the IRB professional's point of view with regards to having one site that may not be affiliated directly, let's say with your organization, having oversight via their federal insurance with a project that's being conducted in your hospital.
You know, that's a really great question, and my gut says that for institutions that have IRBs, that would never fly. We would never rely on a centralized or national IRB, nor would we want to. But I think the intent of this, and I am not OHARP, so I can't speak for them, but I think the intent of this is to provide a venue. In Michigan hospitals, for example, the majority of hospitals that participated in this quality improvement research don't have IRBs. They don't conduct clinical research. They don't have institutional review boards. They would not participate in the project, or they would have to go through a centralized IRB, which is not significantly different than what potentially is proposed here. So I think that part of where OHARP is going with this is trying to be responsive. But remember, those things I put up were ideas that were out there for public comment. What I think we all know about health policy in the U.S. and the changing of rules and regulations is that public comment means a lot, and we'll have to see where that unfolds.
Yeah, that's a great point that you made. We actually had that same experience with the ISRN, is that we had these documents, we had these processes in place where our University of Texas Health Science Center, San Antonio IRB, can sign investigator agreements with other organizations that are participating in multi-site projects. But like you said, if institutions have their local IRB, the IRB is not going to go for another institutional review board having oversight to their hospitals. And that's a great point that you make. And looking at the clock now, it's a little after 2, and unfortunately that means that we're out of time. And again, thank you, Christine, for such an insightful presentation. and allowing us to take an hour of your time and learning from your experiences through Michigan and your experiences through Dr. Peter Protocol's literature and your happenings with OHARP. With that, I want to let the audience know that we value your feedback and hope that you can spend a few minutes completing the evaluation form that's about to appear on your screen. An archive of this presentation, along with the slides and the audio recording, will be available on the ISRN.net website in a few weeks. In fact, we're going to upload the PowerPoint presentation by the end of the day today, so the audience will have the opportunity to download these slides for their records. And as the registrants for this seminar, we will send you an email invitation, email notification once the archive is available on the ISRN.net website. We also encourage you, if you're interested in taking a deep dive into topics important in quality improvement and evidence-based research, we encourage you to attend the Summer Institutes on Evidence-Based Quality Improvement to be held July 17th through the 21st at the Grand Hyatt in San Antonio, Texas. More information can be found on the website at www.improvementscienceresearch.net. The ISRN is a growing network of researchers, academicians, and healthcare providers. We continue to accept membership applications and invite you to become a member if you are not so already. Being a member of the network allows you to participate in our multitude of multi-site projects that we have in the works right now. Our next project, looking at cognitive load and the impact of cognitive load on medication administration errors, is set to be released in the first quarter of this year, so keep an eye out for that announcement. And to learn more about this and any other opportunities and many other opportunities we have within the Improvement Science Research Network, please visit the ISRN at their website at www.isrn.net or contact the ISRN directly. Thank you everyone for your attendance today and have a good day.